We were joined by Hugh McKay, experienced social psychologist and best-selling author, with Catherine Duplu-Menage, artistic director at Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival. They are great friends and shared a warm and wonderful conversation about Hugh's latest book, The Way We Are, Lessons from a Lifetime of Listening. So Hugh's nonfiction covers social analysis, psychology, communication, and ethics. He is a fellow of the Australian Psychological Society and Royal Society of New South Wales, and has been awarded honorary doctorates at 5 Australian universities. He was appointed an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2015 and is currently an honorary professor in the School of Medicine and Psychology at the Australian National University. Hugh states in The Way We Are, "Life is messy, relationships are complex, outcomes are uncertain, yet none of our differences, whether based on ethnicity, politics, religion, cultural tastes and preferences, or gender, are nearly as significant as the humanity we share." This recording was made at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts in the Henry Carmichael Theatre, which is located on Gadigal land.
Thank you very much. I should also say that I know Hugh quite well. We've known each other for a long time. So if you're shocked by any of my questions, it's really quite friendly. And I haven't got anything too nasty to say. This book is fascinating. It's really, like all Hugh's work, I think, about our society and our place in our society and looking at that from different angles. What the problems are and how they can be approached and how they can be solved, we hope. It's a book that, unusually, I find myself talking to. Ah. So, for example, that's interesting. I see what you mean. Well, yes, but... Or, oh, come on, that's going a bit far. And the end was, Hugh, you really cannot think this. So my bizarre reactions are there to say that it's a book that you immediately engage with. It's not something that you read and think, interesting, put it in the back of your mind. It's something that immediately you engage with and think about yourself when you read it. Sometimes the thoughts are great. Oh, I do that when you're talking about something that is a good thing. And sometimes it's a bit like a mirror that shows you things about yourself that you don't really want to see. But it's always interesting and always challenging. Now, start with a slightly odd question, perhaps. Would it be fair to call you an optimist, Hugh?
Sorry?
And would it be fair to call you an optimist?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, in spite of everything.
Yeah.
Because some people have said, this book it's a bit dark.
It's full of grim things.
There are some fairly bleak findings, which we have to acknowledge about contemporary Australia. But I am fundamentally optimistic. And I suppose spell this out absolutely explicitly in the book. But the reason I'm fundamentally optimistic is that we are human. And in a way, this book is exactly what you've said, Catherine. It is about us and our place in Australia and the state of Australian society. But it's also, to some extent, a book about what it means to be human, because we're humans before we're Australians, and many of the things that we like to brag about as Australians are actually based on our common humanity, not on our nationality. So my optimism arises from the fact that the human species gloriously, wonderfully, is a species capable of great kindness, great compassion. In fact, I do. There's a chapter in the book called "The Survival of the Kindest," in which I quote some recent archaeological work, which is spectacular, and yet shouldn't surprise any of us. It's work done by a group of British and German archaeologists in Europe recently, in which they found in the archaeological record evidence that they believe explains what has been a major archaeological puzzle for a very long time, which is there were 5 species of humans roaming mm-hmm. the planet for about 200,000 to 300,000 years, but only one of those 5 species survived a cataclysmic climatic event that occurred, the archaeologists tell us, about 42,000 years ago that wiped out the Neanderthals, Homo erectus, a couple of others, can't remember their names, sorry species, but Homo sapiens, that very flattering title we've given ourselves, Homo sapiens was the only one of the five to survive. Why? And there's been all sorts of speculation. Did we have bigger brains? Were we cognitively superior? Could we run faster? Did we build better tools or do nicer rock carvings? Or no, the other species seemed not to be inferior to us in those respects. But this was the secret, according to this new work. Homo sapiens alone had figured out how to create relatively small supportive communities, showing kindness, showing compassion, caring for the sick, for the injured and so on. The evidence of this apparently in the archaeological record. And one of the archaeologists, in a very poetic phrase, talked about our emotional vulnerability to each other turning out to be our greatest strength when it came to survival. Now, this is a very long answer to a question, but that gives me enormous encouragement. And we recognise ourselves in that, don't we? That is what we're like. We do create supportive communities. We suffer greatly. I'm sure we'll talk about this in a moment. When we're isolated, when we're not engaged with supportive communities, it is absolutely natural for Homo sapiens to be part of a community. And it's the community that saves us. So I'm optimistic because in spite of all the drama that we're looking at the moment, much of it related to, well, I'm jumping ahead, I'm sure, but much of it related to the number one, get this, the number one public health issue in contemporary Australia, which is no longer obesity. That used to be our number one public health issue. Our number one public health issue in 2024 is social isolation. And social isolation is a public health issue because it's associated with the increased risk of loneliness, anxiety, depression, hypertension, inflammation, sleep disorders, vulnerability to addiction, and reduced life expectancy. So in a way, the central puzzle of the book is, given the nature of our species, which I've very briefly outlined in that reference to the archaeologist, given the nature of our species as inherently social, mutually supportive, mutually dependent, how did our society, and not just ours, it's a Western phenomenon, but how did our society in 2024 reach the point where social isolation is our number one issue?
I was actually going to come exactly to that chapter, which seems to me the key chapter in the book, in a sense, because it's where it's where your view of human nature is most clearly explained. How do you put that view alongside, I'll say, war, you know, people killing each other?
Yes.
Unkindness, but war being perhaps the ultimate expression of unkindness.
Yes, that's about as unkind as we can get.
As unkind as you can get, killing people.
Killing each other.
En masse,
anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. And this is the conundrum. This is the paradox of human nature, isn't it? That at our core, the absolute essence of human nature is based on our need of each other, that we are a cooperative species. In fact, neuroscientists say they can find the cooperative centre in the human brain. It's in our DNA, it's built in. By the way, there's no competitive centre in the human brain. That's a socially conditioned, learned response. We learn quickly and we get very good at it. But that's not who we are in essence. When we're being true to what Abraham Lincoln, once again very poetically, described as the better angels of our nature, then we're cooperating. We're fulfilling what I describe, perhaps rather grandiosely in this book, as the grand human project, which is to create and maintain social harmony. So Catherine's question, of course, is the key question. If that's our destiny, if that's our true nature, how come we kill each other? How come we go to war? How come we don't settle all our disputes amicably and commit ourselves to maintaining social harmony? And the answer is, and I suppose in a way this is a Jungian point, but the answer is that all of the noble aspects of our nature, all of what we think of as the human virtues, do cast shadows. We're capable of great love and of hate. We're capable of cooperation and its shadow, competition. We're capable of compassion and kindness, and we're also capable of cruelty and unkindness. And it's all a question of how we as individuals are conditioned through our early upbringing, because we're born into a cooperative species. What that means is that innately within all of us is the capacity for all the virtues, all the qualities that are required to be members of a cooperative species. By the way, the neuroscientists tell us there's a language center in the human brain as well. In other words, we're born equipped with the capacity for language. We're not born speaking the mother tongue. We have to have it taught, nurtured, reinforced, modelled by parents and teachers and others. And it's exactly the same with the noble human qualities. They have to be nurtured. They have to be encouraged. They have to be reinforced and modelled. And, of course, that is not always the case. Indeed. We know that people are wounded deeply in early childhood and perhaps never recover from that, that people learn as a default position to be cynical or to be suspicious of other people's apparently pure motives, to be unkind in their disposition. But those people are paying an enormous emotional price because they are sacrificing, not embracing, not embodying their true human nature. It's no, just to come back to war, I mean, imagine a species like ours with the wonderful history of survival and doing all the things we've done. Imagine us resorting to violence. Imagine us shooting each other and bombing each other and all those guys. It's no wonder that we decorate so-called war heroes and we give people medals and all that sort of stuff, because what we've asked them to do on our behalf is sacrifice their essential humanity. What a thing to do. Send people off to a war to behave in a subhuman way, to respond to the dark impulses which would normally be overwhelmed by the light.
We expect men to do that more than women. Our society has expected men, they're the ones who have to carry that burden. So perhaps it isn't a surprise what happens to many men.
That's right. I mean, we hear now, we're understanding, we've just had this Royal Commission into suicides from members of the armed forces. We know that PTSD has been an issue for people returning from combat zones forever, for centuries. We've only very recently understood it medically. The mystery to me is how anyone could return from a combat zone not suffering from PTSD.
Not damaged.
Yeah, not damaged.
In worrying ways.
Because look what we've asked them to do, shoot people, kill other people's husbands, brothers, sons, daughters, etc. And yet we can talk about just wars and we can talk about having virtue on our side and all of that. Nevertheless, to decide that a dispute is going to be resolved in this way is to diminish our humanity. In the same way, and this is a bit of a footnote to that in a way, but I think it's worth registering at this point in the conversation, we also diminish our humanity when we become too puffed up about our own personal identity. One of the characteristics of a society that's become more socially fragmented, as our society has, we'll talk about some of the factors that have done that to us, But one of the features of that is that we see the rise of the so-called me culture, in which many people become obsessed about their gender or their ethnicity or their religion or their politics or their cultural tastes and preferences. All of those things fundamentally important to our sense of self. I'm not diminishing the importance of any of those things, but they pale almost into insignificance compared with the fact that we share a common humanity, that we are one, that the main thing about you and me is how we're the same.
Yeah.
And it's also true, of course, that we're different. You're female, I'm male for a start. You have different politics, perhaps. You have different religious motivations, perhaps. I don't know. But all of that, important though it is, if we allow... I mean, we're in the era of identity politics, for example, very dangerous for us, very fragmenting. We're in the era of the obsession with personal identity, as though those things about me, the things that make me unique and different and special, and we're all unique, different and special, but as though that's the most important thing you need to know about me. Well, no, it isn't. The most important thing you need to know about me is that I'm like you and that we're all human.
And that we can make links rather than break them. Mm. I thought I'd just take a step to the side to ask you whether it would be fair to say that this book is less based on specific research and observation, more on really pulling together what you have observed through your life as a social researcher. Mm. Is that a fair way of looking at it?
It is. It is. This is my last non-fiction book.
Yeah, you always say that, Hugh.
No.
I've heard you say that at least once, if not more.
Once. I was persuaded to... I had finished, but I was persuaded to come back to this for precisely the reason that you've raised, actually, Catherine, and that is the publisher said, look, you've been at this for a very long time. I started work at the age of 16 and I'm now 86, so it is actually quite a long period. Why don't you give us the long view? Why don't you reflect on all of this research that you've been doing? And rather, as you say, rather than just focusing on specific bits of research, there are some, quite a lot of particular pieces of research, but rather than this being a compendium of research findings, it is very much... the long view. It's very much an assessment of how we got to where we are. And it's also a bit cheekier than my previous nonfiction, I think, in the sense that I have allowed myself at the end of each chapter to offer some very personal reflections on the themes that I've been drawing out. So that is an act. I'm not suggesting that it's no longer research-based. It's very much a research-based book. But it's less about the research and more about what are we going to do with what we now know about ourselves.
One of the questions that I'd like to ask about... So at the end of the book, you've got something called a technical index about how you carried out your research when you did. And it seems to... I know it's a bit odd to start at the end of a book, but it seems to me that we're always being told things about ourselves as a society. Research tells us that. You know, research says...
Every day.
This. Oh, more than once a day. How are these conclusions reached? How do people do research, social research? Mm.
Well, they do it worse and worse. I'm sorry to say that. But the techniques, it's a huge subject. And of course, the work that the Census Bureau, the Bureau of Census and Statistics does, the census is a form of social research. Mm. It's the most accurate social research we ever get. And some of the intercensal work that the Bureau does is absolutely brilliant by world standards. I mean, if you really want to know essential facts about contemporary Australia, go to the ABS website and take a look at what they've been doing. Their survey work is just as brilliant as the census itself.
In terms of numbers of people doing things, so what kind of...
Some of it is attitude research too, but most of it is more to do with our characteristic and our behaviour. But more and more, and I suppose it's in a way it's a function of the fact that we have become a more fragmented, more troubled, I've suggested in the book, more wounded society. People are perhaps therefore correspondingly more interested in the state of the nation, in the state of play. So there's no, as I say, almost every day there's another little piece of research, and some of it is based on someone who ran two or three so-called focus groups and from that drew a conclusion about human nature or the state of Australia or the next election or something. Ridiculous. Or increasingly online research, which is still in its infancy and very hard to validate. So there's a lot of very, very quick and dirty research that's being published as if, and journalists in particular seem not yet to have had the courage to interrogate this research as sharply as they should, as rigorously as they should, and say, well, hang on, you're saying, you know, the focus groups are this. How many focus groups? Who was in them? What was the method? Where did you do this?
How representative and in what way?
Yes, all of that. My own research, I started out as a quantitative researcher doing surveys based on random probability samples and yielding statistics, but I gradually moved into the qualitative side of research, which is really the side that addresses the question why. We always need quantitative data that tells us what people are doing, where they're going, how much they're spending, how many children they have, where they live, how they vote, all of those factual things. But qualitative research arose as a discipline to try and get a bit beneath the surface statistics and say, why is this? Why is the birth rate going through the floor? Why have people voted this way? Why are people living in this way? And that's a much more difficult thing to address. You can't do that by a simple set of questions. And that's why techniques like the unstructured personal interview, conversational kind of interview, and in particular small group discussions arose as a very useful way of letting people ruminate about a subject without having to answer questions about it, where the role of the researcher is really just to listen in and try to interpret all of these things that people are saying. But there have to be vast numbers of people saying them before we can be confident. I am perplexed by what's happening to qualitative research now. I mean, literally people do two or three groups in one place and try and draw national conclusions from it.
Mm.
So when you're looking at a piece of research, whether in the media or online or elsewhere,
ask that question.
Yourself, who did this? How did they do it? How extensive was it?
Yeah, and I just thought that was good to throw in. So, but back to the book. So the subtitle is Lessons from a Lifetime of Listening. Now, this is kind of impossible, but if I were to ask you for one or maybe two conclusions, lessons that you've learned, what would you say they were? You've touched on one already, which is that there's more that brings us together.
Yes. I suppose that if I had to focus on two, I think they would be number one, that even though there are circumstances in which we resist it, the tug of community is ultimately irresistible. That I talk in the book about what I describe as the beautiful symmetry of the human condition, which is that we need communities to nurture us and sustain us, to give us that all-important sense of belonging, which is absolutely fundamental to the mental and emotional health of people like us, because, back to the very beginning of the conversation, because we belong to a social species, because we're human. We absolutely need communities. We need families, neighbourhoods, work colleagues, friendship circles, faith communities, ukulele clubs, choirs, community, anything that brings us together, puts us in touch with each other. The profound importance of community to our mental health, I suppose, is a primary conclusion. The other one, and I'm sure you've found this yourself, I hope you have, but I've certainly found it because as a researcher, my job has been to listen. Everybody's story is interesting. When I hear someone say, oh, he's such a boring person, I think, ah, so you haven't been listening. Nobody is a boring person. I've had people who say, oh, you're not interested in my opinion. Well, yes, I am. And if you talk for long enough, I'll be riveted because your story will be just as fascinating, just as complex as everybody else's story, and you'll have had to deal with sadness and disappointment and loss and tragedy just as everybody else has if they've lived long enough, and you'll have had secret little joys and triumphs, magic moments in your life just as everyone else has. And I'd love to know all that about you. Nothing I like more than listening to people telling their story. So our desperate need of community for our mental health and the fact that everyone's story is interesting, those would be, I think, my two primary lessons, yes. No one's asked me that before. Isn't that amazing? And it says lessons on the front of the book.
Good, great. well, let's go back to, given this, that you're an optimist, given the positive things you've said, why are we, as I think you said in a chapter, more fragmented than ever?
Yeah, born to connect, born to lonelier connect, that's than right. ever.
Born to connect, but lonelier than ever. And needing to connect, but lonelier than ever. Hmm. Do you want to give us some of the, talk a bit about that, some of the reasons?
Yeah, well, that is really the whole framework of the book, the explanation for that. It does sound very bleak, doesn't it, when you say born to connect, but lonelier than ever. And yet let's not ignore the fact that we are suffering an epidemic of loneliness in Australia. And when I say an epidemic, I can give you some figures because there was a very respectable piece of social research conducted last year, a national survey, which revealed that 32% of Australian adults report feeling lonely. That's almost one in three of us report feeling lonely. And the loneliest age cohort in our society are the 18 to 24-year-olds who's...
Really counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd imagine older people who have retired, whose partners may have died, who may be living on their own, being lonely. Yeah. But 18 to 24-year-olds...
Yeah, 38% of 18 to 24-year-olds report feeling lonely, even though they are the most connected generation via social media in human history. So we've got an epidemic of loneliness, we've got an epidemic of anxiety, we've got an epidemic of depression. And so how did this happen? That's hence that chapter heading, born to connect but lonelier than ever. How did it happen? And in a way that there are too many answers for us to discuss properly now, but let me just very quickly identify some of the factors that have brought us to that. And let me preface it by saying that these trends that I'm about to describe, which are the evidence of social fragmentation and some erosion of social cohesion, these trends are the result of choices that we ourselves have been making about how to live. It's not as though someone wagged their cosmic finger at us and said, ha, I'm going to give you a rough 50 years. I'm going to do all these things to your society and see how you cope with that. No, you'll recognise in the trends that I'm about to describe very briefly, you'll recognise yourself and other members of your family and friends. These are things that we've done. So what have we done? Number one, by far the biggest social and demographic change in Australian society, turning us into a society unlike human society has ever been before, this is a big build-up, isn't it, is our shrinking households. In the last 100 years, Australian society, as the Australian population has increased fivefold. In the same period, the number of households in Australia has increased tenfold. So we're creating households at twice the rate we're growing the population. In other words, our households are getting smaller and smaller. Mm. The average Australian household today is 2.5 people. 25%, and it's growing. The Bureau of Statistics is predicting it'll get over 30% within the next 10 to 15 years. But at the moment, 25% of all Australian households, one household in four, including many of us in this room, contains just one person. We have never in our history lived like that. Roughly three-fifths of women over the age of 60 live alone. That has never been the case in our history. Now, I'm not suggesting... by the way, if you put single-person and two-person households together, you get about 53% of all Australian households. And by the way, as a little footnote to this, I'm no economist, but I can't resist saying, we don't have a housing shortage. What we have is an excess of demand for housing because we're living in ones and twos. And mostly we're living in two, three or four bedroom houses. The houses are getting bigger, the households are getting smaller. We're a nation of spare rooms.
spare floors in some cases.
Sorry?
Spare whole floors. Yes. Spare wings.
Yes, spare wings.
And don't get me started on
bathrooms. And on census night, the last census, 1 million dwellings were empty. And now we're talking about a housing crisis. Well, we'd all better start doing what we were doing 100 years ago, which is bunking in with each other a bit more. Three generations under one roof. We say, oh, gee, I don't know if I want to live with my kids and grandkids, but the tension might be quite good for us. but this is a weird way to live. I live in a two-person household. I've been living in a single-person household before I... Recently, 20 years ago, late in life, remarried. But a lot of us live, I'm sure many, do you mind me asking roughly how many of you live alone? Right, okay. Well, that's at least 25% of the people here. That's the way we're living. Now, I'm not suggesting, and let me be really clear about this, I'm not suggesting that everyone who lives alone is lonely. It's possible to be lonely in a marriage. It's possible to be lonely in a crowded house. Living alone doesn't guarantee loneliness and doesn't guarantee social isolation. Many people absolutely love living alone. They've chosen to live alone. They say, I've got family, I've got neighbours, I've got colleagues, I've got friends, I can socialise myself to death daily, and then I come home and shut the door behind me and punch the air and say, peace, alone at last. Isn't this wonderful? Yes, there are people like that, but it is a very unusual way to live, especially if there are three bedrooms when you get home to this empty house. But there are people who don't feel like that. I've done a lot of work over the years on solo householders, and of course all their stories are different. It's a very diverse cohort, but there are many people who don't punch the air and say, peace, alone at last. There are many people who ache with loneliness about their solo householder status. They yearn for a companion to be living with them. Perhaps they've been bereaved or experienced a relationship breakdown or a change in life circumstances that pitchforked them into living alone. They're the people who say, when I go out, I turn on the lights and the television. So when I come home, I won't feel as if I'm coming home to a lonely, empty house and so on. So I'm not generalising about this, but I am saying when a society... By the way, this trend started in the 1930s, and it started with the rise of the nuclear family as the household unit. That is a very, very modern fashion. Mm. Previously, three generations or the odd... aunt and uncle or a lodger or two, much more typical. I mean, 100 years ago, our households were twice the size they are now.
And not just because we had more children.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The birth rate, of course, keeps plummeting. That's another issue. I'm going on much too long about this, but it is the biggest factor. All I'm saying about it is when we've reached the stage that we've now reached, the risk of social isolation is greatly increased. And those of us who are not socially isolated, I believe, have a moral obligation, because we belong to this species, because we're human, we have a moral obligation to take a look around the street where we live or the apartment block where we live and see if there are people living alone who are at risk of social isolation, and perhaps we need to reach out to them. The more socially isolated people become, the lonelier they become, the less likely they are to reach out to us. They become more and more indrawn, withdrawn, more and more inward in their focus. That's a phenomenon of loneliness. So it's our responsibility to save them from that, to reach out. Anyway, enough of that. Very quickly, a few other social trends. High rate of relationship breakdown, between 35 and 40%. Mm. Contemporary marriages are ending in divorce. Contributing to social fragmentation, a two-person household becomes two single-person households, at least for a while. Catherine mentioned the falling birth rate. I think that's actually another contributor to social fragmentation. Any of you who are parents will know that in the past, if you moved into a new neighbourhood, it was usually the kids who got to know the other kids first, and gradually networks developed through the neighbourhood, courtesy of the sort of social lubricant that kids supplied. Well, we are now producing, relative to total population, we're producing the smallest generation of children Australia has ever produced. Some of you in this room are baby boomers. If this year you're turning somewhere between 63 and 78, you're a boomer. And that in those 15 years, the birth rate hit 3.6 babies per woman. It is now 1.6 when I wrote the book. It's now 1.5 and still falling. And some of the countries of Western Europe have lower birth rates than we do. So the low birth rate is a potentially a socially fragmenting a phenomenon. We compensate. Catherine and I were talking before the session started about how we compensate, and one of the ways we compensate, just take a look at the graph of the falling birth rate and compare it with the graph of the rising rate of pet ownership.
Particularly dogs.
Yes. There are now more pets than people in Australia.
Seriously?
There are 26 million of us. There are 29 million of them.
Seriously?
Yeah. That includes goldfish and
hamsters and snakes.
But you know, particularly dogs and cats, obviously. And you know that they're child substitutes because of the names they're being given. I've mentioned in the book that I'd recently met a dog called Ian. And when I told someone else that, they said, "Oh, my dog's called Hugh." No doubt there's a Catherine.
Oh, probably plethora. I was telling Hugh of a story of a family I know who called their children and their pets by incredibly similar names. So the dog was Susan and the girl was Sarah. And an uncle confused them and gave them the wrong name. He was not a favourite uncle for that reason.
Yes, you meet someone at the dog walking park and is he Nigel or is Nigel the dog?
Spot was much easier. So
just a couple of weeks ago, in a session where I was talking about the book, a woman came up to me after the session and said, "We have a pet snake called Jeff."
I don't know what's more surprising, the pet snake or the name, really. Or giving the pet snake a name.
Anyway, so falling birth rate. Very quickly, our increasing mobility. We've become, just like North Americans, we've become a society in which we move house on average once every 6 years. So people are moving in and out of neighbourhoods, connecting or failing to connect with neighbours at an increasing rate compared with our past history. And of course, we're also more mobile in the sense that we have almost universal car ownership. Most of us live in drive-in, drive-out suburbs where you wave at your neighbour's car. And given the fashion for tinted windows, you can't even be sure that it's your neighbour driving. But it's very different from stopping on the footpath and saying g'day, isn't it? In some of the new housing developments in our outer metropolitan areas, there are no footpaths because there's no demand for footpath traffic. So that's a weird phenomenon. I spoke recently to a young woman who's just moved into a new subdivision in Orange in the Central West. She said she's lived there for 6 months. She hasn't yet met her neighbours. They all come and go by car. They've all got electric garage doors. Up goes the door, in goes the car, down comes the door. I didn't say you could have knocked on their door and said hello, but anyway, that hasn't happened. 6 months. So our increased mobility is an issue.
Can I just interrupt you, Hugh? Because I think of you as the person... I've never met somebody who talks about neighbours as much as you do. Mm. And it's actually... on a personal note, really impacted on my life, because we were talking a couple of years ago about another book.
Yes.
And I thought, you're completely right. I don't know my neighbours. Yeah. So I have personally gone out of my way to talk to my neighbours.
Right.
And it's great.
Yeah, it is great. And there's nothing... I mean, I say in the book, it sounds like a cliche, but it's something I really believe. The state of the nation starts in your street. Mm. I mean, friends are wonderful, families are sometimes wonderful. neighbours are not necessarily our friends. They may never become our friends, but there's this unique thing about neighbours. You buy a house or rent a house or an apartment and you move in, and suddenly you are actually living within a local neighbourhood. And because we're humans, it seems to me, we do have a moral obligation to act like neighbours. A really sad piece of research that was published by Edith Cowan University a few years ago, I've quoted it in the book, it was close to 50% of Australians, 50%, said they felt they could not trust their neighbours to help out in an emergency. And of course, when there is an emergency, a fire, a flood, a pandemic, or something else, it turns out, of course, we can trust our neighbours, we pitch in and help each other. But people saying that was really a reflection of what Catherine described before her conversion to being a neighbour,
right.
which is that we don't know our neighbours well enough to know we can trust them. Or they don't know us well enough to know they can trust us. Of course we're going to help out if the roof blows off or if there's a sudden death in the family or some other crisis. Of course we're going to help out because we're human. But the sense that people don't know that is deeply
sad. It is pretty terrifying. And it's much harder to be unpleasant to somebody you know.
Mm. Yes.
You know,
If
you talk to your neighbour and they, you know, the next day they have their music on, it's deafening. Well, it's easier to say, look, sorry, but could you turn it down
yes,
a bit?
Yes.
Because you've got that human contact. But I exactly. digress.
Yeah. I just add two other things to this little list, and then I'm done on this bit. But they're two very important points, really. One is busyness. Busyness is the great enemy of social cohesion. Will you please bear that in mind? We're all so proud of our busyness. It's even affected the way we greet each other in Australia. I've noticed over the last few years, how are you going, Catherine? Busy?
Terribly busy.
It's all part of the... And then it's your sort of civic duty to say, oh, yeah, I'm you know, I'm retired people. Some of you may be retired. I'm so busy, I don't know how I ever found time to go to work.
I have to confess,
Why?
My husband says that. But the plus side is that actually he's filled his life with things he loves.
Look, there are good aspects to it, but if we're so busy that it's getting in the way of the time we need to nurture relationships, especially neighbourhood relationships, the neighbours are having drinks on Friday night, sorry, too busy. Now, don't disturb Dad, he's busy. As though busyness is the excuse for withholding social interaction.
Mm.
So that's another factor contributing to the fragmentation. And the other one, you'd be wondering why I didn't mention this first, but the other obvious one is information technology, which has done brilliantly what it promised to do, namely it has made us more connected than ever before in human history, and it's done what it never promised to do, but we're now understanding what it's doing, which is made it easier than ever before in human history to stay apart from each other and to settle for screen-based connection. And why is that socially fragmenting? Well, let me give you two words which explain why it's socially fragmenting, and the two words are eye contact. Neuroscientists tell us the absolutely crucial ingredient in human interaction is eye contact. That's the superhighway to the brain, the superhighway to the heart in the emotional, in the metaphorical sense. When we connect with another person, the crucial component, crucial component of being present to another person is eye contact. And if you doubt it, just remember what it's like when you're trying to talk to someone who refuses to make eye contact with you. It's a very, very eloquent message, isn't it? Well, the truth about information technology is you can't make eye contact. You can stare at someone's image on the screen, but you're staring at a screen. You can think that you're looking right into their eyes, and what it looks like at the other end is that you're looking down. And if you look straight at the camera, so it looks to them as though you're looking them in the eye, then you can't see them because you're looking at the... I mean, it's a weird trick that we're playing on our brains, saying, let's pretend this is like person-to-person interaction. It's not like person-to-person interaction at all. You can't satisfy the human need to belong via social media or information technology-based connection at all. If we trade off, as we are now in danger of doing, and as that 18 to 24-year-old cohort is already doing, if we trade off too much face-to-face, eye contact-based personal interaction in favour of interaction via technology, we're likely to suffer from what a very clever psychotherapist in Melbourne, Michelle Lim, has described as social hunger. And social hunger, like physical hunger, does things to us that we're not really conscious of. When you're physically hungry, you get a bit cranky, don't you? You get a bit irritable. People are much more annoying before lunch than they are after lunch. There's a very interesting study, which I quoted in the book, of a parole board about the decisions they made before and after lunch. And the conclusion I can express just by giving you a piece of advice: if you ever have to go before a parole board, make sure you get an after-lunch appointment, because they make much more generous decisions after lunch. So physical hunger makes us cranky and irritable. Social hunger does exactly the same thing. And one of the reasons why there's so much abuse, trolling, bullying, humiliation, really bad behaviour on social media, and we keep hearing about it, don't we, almost every day, is that the heaviest users of social media are probably socially hungry. And they don't know why they're angry. They don't know why they're violent in their disposition or why they're unkind or...
critical and, yeah.
All that stuff. But they are, because they're hungry. Not physically, but socially. And I'd add one other little point to that too, which is not really discussed at all in all this conversation. I mean, we're beginning to understand the hazard. The South Australian Parliament is now working on a bill to limit access to social media to kids under 14, I think, and federally we're talking about under 16. But there's another, it's not just social hunger. There's also a moral dimension to this, because our moral sense is a social sense. We develop our sense of right and wrong, good and bad. Our moral compass is set through the experience of interacting with each other, negotiating particularly difficult neighbours. That's how we refine our moral sensitivity. if we are depriving ourselves of too much face-to-face contact, our moral sensitivity, our moral clarity is likely to be diminished. So again, there's a simple explanation for bad behavior online, which is not just social hunger, but also perhaps some moral diminishment. So put all that together, that's a very long, I mean, I think probably appropriate to spend that amount of time because it is the framework for the entire book. But put all those things together and then go back to our very first point in response to Catherine's opening question. We're humans. We belong to a social species. We need each other. We're all one. We rely on communities. The sense of belonging is fundamental. And yet, we've done all these things to ourselves. And now we find ourselves facing as a serious social issue, the problem of social isolation. Very unhealthy. Not surprising at all that we've got epidemics of mental illness. Of course we've got epidemics of mental illness because we're social beings.
We're lonely. We're not having that connection that we need.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So but if people have got questions, I will come to you, so start to think of them. But what I wanted to ask you was it's been a bit gloomy so far. Can we look at how, but on the other hand, the mirror image of the negative things you said are there immediately. If you're lonely, then you have to be connected. Mm. How do we go about changing what's the matter? Mm. Identifying it, I think, is always a good start. And that you do that very clearly. What do we do?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what we don't do first. We don't ask the government to do something about this. The UK have appointed a minister for loneliness.
Have they?
I don't know what the current status of that is. The initial minister for loneliness under the Conservative government resigned.
too solitary.
Lonely at the top. So I don't know whether they have one now, but they had a ministry for loneliness. Now that was exactly the wrong strategy. They'd correctly diagnosed the problem, but the government isn't going to do it. We're not going to have a minister for loneliness. We're not going to have. I mean, governments are starting to talk about the problem of social cohesion. They're talking about it, particularly in relation to anti-Semitism or Islamophobia and so on. Of course, these things erode social cohesion. But the real solution to this lies with you and me and Catherine. The real solution is person by person, household by household, street by street, apartment block by apartment block, we need to connect. We need to look out. I mentioned it in passing earlier. We need to look out for the people who are at risk of social isolation and not say, I'm going to befriend you, because you might be completely incompatible in terms of friendship, but you're not completely incompatible because you're both humans. So I'll reach out. I'll take you a basket of lemons, or I'll say, look, I've made a bit more soup than I need. Can I offer you some? Or anything.
We even just say hello, which is a start.
There's a chilling story that I tell in the book about a young bloke in Canberra just a couple of years ago who attempted to take his own life by jumping off a bridge. He survived and he was dragged out of the lake. And the person who rescued him said the first thing this young man said to him was, if someone had smiled at me, I wouldn't have jumped. Now, some of you will remember who Martin Bryant is, the Port Arthur massacre person. I mean, an appalling story. At his trial, you may recall, one of the things we learned about Martin Bryant was that he used to buy airline tickets and go on flights to places that he didn't want to go to just so he would be sitting next to someone who would be forced to talk to him. He was so socially isolated that he went to that trouble to try and get someone to talk to him. So, yes, smile. Don't ever stand at a bus stop and ignore someone. Just say, I think it might rain, or, well, the bus is late again, or just, hello, anything. But last week we had Are You OK Day, and sometimes people do look a bit miserable. And it's very, I mean, yesterday I was slightly confused in the CBD, and someone came up to me and said, Are you OK? Do you need help? And lovely. I said, no, I'm fine. I'm just a bit disorientated. I'm a boy from the bush these days. I moved to Canberra. But that's lovely. That's a little connection. It's so easy to do as you pass someone in their front garden, just say hello, or a stranger on the bus or anything. So the dream that we all dream, I'm sure, when we dream of a better society, we're dreaming of a more connected, socially cohesive society. We're dreaming of a society in which we're kinder to each other, more compassionate, more tolerant, more accepting of each other. Isn't that what we dream of? Well, again, don't wait for the government to appoint the kindness police kindness task force to come around and knock on your door and say, were you kind to anyone yesterday? No, won't happen. But ask yourself that, and ask your grandkids, who were you kind to today? Get it back into the conversation. Did you talk to anyone you didn't know today? Was there a lonely kid in the playground? Did you help that person out? And interrogate yourself. Did I miss an opportunity to rescue someone from the possibility of social isolation today? Make it a daily challenge to make these connections. And that's transformative. And it's being true to your nature. It's a human being a human. I mean, kindness, again, in the chapter on kindness in the book, I actually define it. You may think you don't have to define kindness. We all know what it is. But because we're social beings, our deepest psychological need, part of that need to belong, our deepest psychological need is to be acknowledged, to be taken seriously by other people, to be included, to be appreciated, to be understood. And kindness is anything we do, anything, like the smile, like the wave, like the chance comment, anything we do that says to another person, I take you seriously enough to greet you. I take you seriously enough to listen attentively to what you want to say to me. I take you seriously enough just to wave at you as we pass in the street. Samuel Johnson very wisely, I don't agree with everything that old Sam said, but 250 years ago he said something so smart, I think we should write it down and stick it up on the fridge. And it's about the essence of being human. Kindness is in our power, even when fondness is not. In other words, we are capable of being kind to people we don't like. We're capable of being kind to people we could never agree with about politics or religion or anything else. We're capable of being kind to total strangers. And we're capable of being kind without discrimination. Kindness is a form of love. All forms of love are wonderful, but most forms of love are to do with the emotions. And kindness, this wonderfully distinguishing characteristic of our species, kindness is the only form of love that doesn't depend on our emotions at all. For all those reasons, we're capable of being kind to anyone. And we don't do it in a discriminatory way. A young bloke, I wish this had happened in time for me to put it in the book, a young bloke who lives in the apartment block where I live in Canberra noticed that the car belonging to one of our elderly residents had a flat tyre. This is just a couple of weeks ago. He went and knocked on her door and said, oh, Jeanette, you've got a flat tyre, I'll change your wheel for you. Well, one sentence, really. He's not a hero. I mean, he's a lovely young bloke. He's a good neighbour to have. But that's human, being human. That's not heroic. And notice he did not say, Jeanette, you've got a flat tyre, and actually I probably could change that wheel for you, but first I need to know, how did you vote in the voice referendum? where do you stand on bodily resurrection? Who's your favourite author? No, He didn't have a checklist to say, are you worthy of my kindness? I'm a human, you're a human, we're kind to each other because that's the essence of this beautiful species we belong to. So of course I'll change your wheel because I'm young and strong and fit and you're not. It just happens. And my wife tripped over in the street in Brisbane a few months ago. I think I did mention this in the book. I don't think I said it was my wife. Fell flat on her face, smashed her glasses, blood, the whole thing. A young woman appeared out of the crowd, picked her up, wiped her face, accompanied her back to her hotel and handed her over to the staff and so on. Not a second thought. This was, you know, this woman was on her way home from work. She might have been going to meet her boyfriend. I don't know. Just helped. And isn't that what we do when we're being true to our nature and remembering that for people who belong to this species, kindness should come as naturally as breathing. The human organism can't survive without breathing in and out, and the human spirit can't flourish without the giving and receiving of kindness. Sorry.
Hugh, I think...
a bit of a rant.
I actually want to stop there because I don't think anything could be stronger than that. I think that's a fabulous thing to say. Thank you so much.
A huge thank you to Hugh and Catherine, our live audience, and to you listening at home. SMSA members can borrow The Way We Are from our library on Level 2. You can also purchase a copy from your local bookstore. We've left a link to our friends at Abby's Bookshop in the accompanying text. Thanks for tuning in and have a wonderful rest of your day.